You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Great. So welcome, everybody, and welcome to Jim. Thank you, Jim, for joining us. Jim came to us through Jake Shapiro of PRX, and he's going to be talking to us today about application developers and the future of music. Jim is the CEO of the Echoness, and I think he's going to tell us a little bit more about that today. So welcome.
Thanks. Well, thanks for having me. As Ramon mentioned, I'm the CEO of the Echoness. We're a music intelligence company. I'll get into a little bit about what we do, but really what I'm here to talk about today is the future of the music business, and I'm going to show it to you right now. There he is, application developers. So as access to music has become a commodity, whether you're accessing music through a peer-to-peer network or through a cloud music service or through your own hard drive, getting access to that audio stream is obviously really, really easy today. But where the value is shifting is in the experience. The applications that people are accessing music through. If you think about Pandora, for example, how many here are familiar with Pandora? Okay. If I asked that question before the iPhone or iOS store existed, I'm sure that number would be considerably fewer. So applications and application development have really are shaping how people are experiencing music in the app networks and app stores are where most consumers are accessing those applications. So how these applications are changing what the role that music plays in our lives? Well, music's more interactive. So interactive rhythm games like Guitar Hero, Tap Tap Revenge allow you to actually stream music and play along as you're listening to the music. So actually getting inside the music itself and interacting with it. This is a rhythm game that you can basically play a Tapulous style game with any song in your personal collection. More web connected. So MTV is a company that we work with, and MTV has just relaunched. They're the largest music site on the web. They just relaunched MTV.com, and I think there are two really interesting trends bundled up in what MTV is doing. First and foremost, they've come up with a chart of the up-and-coming artists on the web, and recognizing that MTV's kind of editorial team is no longer the tastemaker for the rest of the world out there. Three or four people in Times Square can't tell the rest of us what to listen to. MTV has recognized that. And so what they're doing is using our platform to understand what everyone on the web is listening to, what they're writing about, who they're talking about, harnessing that to kind of bubble up to everyone the top 100 artists that are bubbling up on the web right now. So these are artists that you likely haven't heard of before. They're not getting rotation in MTV, but the web is talking about them quite a bit. And that editorial experience going from, say, the weekly edition of Rolling Stone to a much more web-connected, real-time editorial feed, Twitter feeds, constantly updated blog streams, etc. More personalized. So we talked about Pandora. The Echoness powers a lot of personalized radio playlisting type applications. Here's an example of a ThumbPlay streaming music app where from any seed track of 8 million tracks, you can basically create a radio station at the track level. So here's an example of an acoustic blues tune. And I'll get into our platform a bit, but in the background, our platform's analyzing how the audio sounds, how the world is describing it, to generate a playlist of tracks that sound very, very similar to that seed track, as you can tell. So your ability to go from 18 radio formats, and basically that's all you can do, to literally creating a radio station from one of 8 million tracks is another area where these applications are making music much more personalized. And overall, just much more engaging. So going from basically a lean-back stream experience to a much more interactive experience app that allows you to navigate through your personal collection in like a 3D space. So prior to digital, these types of format shifts or different ways that people experience music took place about every decade. So you'd go from the cassette to the CD, Those format shifts were big, hulking industry changes. Now those shifts are taking place literally almost every day, where any application developer can go ahead, build an application, and change the way you can experience music. So that's all the good news. And these apps are thriving. So music is typically in the top third of application categories, depending on whose research you buy. Gaming, news and information, and music are typically the top, both the top applications being downloaded by the average consumer, iOS, iPad, and also the top type of content that consumers are interacting with on those devices. So that is the good news. So music applications, alive and well, thriving. And thousands of independent application developers are working to reshape the music space. Bad news is most of these guys are locked out of the business. So unlike building a social game, unlike building a news aggregation application that anyone in this room could build, publish to the iPhone App Store, and start building a business, music is different. Music requires navigating all of the rights issues around music publishing, around the record labels, and also getting access to those players in the first place. So we've got a community of about 6,000 application developers building lots and lots of applications, but many of them are sitting on the shelf because they're not able to connect to the licensed services. So I'll give you a little bit more background on the Echo Nest. Brian and Tristan Jahan founded the company when they got their PhDs at MIT. And the concept behind the company is to build a machine learning system that understands music the way you or I do, but does it at scale automatically. And we're doing that by combining what we call content understanding of music, where our platform can listen to music. It can analyze a full-length audio file in a few seconds, that's going, and tell you things like the pitch, the tempo, the time signature. Very similar to what Pandora does, but they do it manually. So over the last decade, Pandora's hired musicians to put on headphones and type in attributes like chromatic chord progression. And those attributes are what make up the radio service that we've all used. Over the last decade, they've indexed about 800,000 tracks. So if you're a Rhapsody or a Google and you've got 10 million tracks you're trying to put in front of users, obviously hiring musicians, although very noble, is not a scalable way to cover 10 million tracks. So we're able to do that in a few seconds through DSP, through analyzing the audio signal. And we combine that with cultural understanding, where we're crawling the web, analyzing all the text written about music on the web all the time in real time to understand how the web is describing every artist, album, and track and who these people are. So we're taking this combination of content level understanding, how the music sounds, and cultural understanding, how people are describing it, to try to approximate how you and I understand music. And what comes out of that is just a ton of data. So similar artists in tags based on how the web is describing every artist, analytics around how familiar or popular artists are in different segments of the web, indexing all of the information, the bios, blogs, news, reviews. And then at the track level, really detailed data down to the song structure or every rhythmic event in the song, the tempo of the song. And what we call fanalytics, which are basically looking at who these people are talking about artists on the web. So understanding the demographic profiles of an artist fan base, their preferences to other forms of entertainment. And we take all of this data and basically open it up for application developers to build a wide range of apps. So some of those app developers are, you know, their day job is working at MTV and powering large commercial services. But we've also built a community of about 6,000 of these independent app developers. And that's really kind of the focus of the talk is the fact that these guys are building really amazing things, but largely locked out of the industry, and many of the things that they're building you haven't seen yet because they're difficult to commercialize. Applications that people are building range from a lot of music discovery and playlisting type applications to rhythm games, music visualizers and remix applications, to even some analytics and targeted marketing type applications. So I'm going to show you some of the things that these guys are building. So this is all the applications I'll show you now. I think all of them were built at a Music Hack Day. Music Hack Days are these events that take place all over the world. We hosted one in Boston in October. About 350 developers showed up and spent the entire weekend building music apps. Most of the apps, I think, I'm pretty sure all of them were built during one of those 48-hour periods. So this app is kind of a a more granular version of Pandora, where you can create not just a playlist based on a seed artist, but say, give me artists that are only within 100 miles of my location. You can select the key or the tempo of the artist. This is a San Francisco-based artist, similar to the Black Keys. And then really detailed data about every one of the artists and tracks, all the news and information about the artist. You can also generate playlists based on any term. So create a playlist of academic experimental electronic music. And using our APIs, there you go. So moving from the idea of just a handful of genres to literally kind of how you and I just describe music and discuss it. And again, this application built in a weekend at a music cafe. Detailed information about the artist and the track, just aggregating all the news and stuff on the web. It's another example of a playlisting application. Using the same type of data, but just a different UI. Some guys in Australia built this application, streaming radio app. Here's a totally different app, 6 Degrees of Black Sabbath. So similar to the Kevin Bacon game, drawing connections between any two artists. So from Justin Bieber to Jimi Hendrix in 4 steps. Justin Bieber collaborated with Usher, who was on a record with R. Kelly, who covered an Isley Brothers track, and Jimmy played in the Isley Brothers for a brief period of time. So there you go, from Justin Bieber to Jimi Hendrix in 4 steps. Again, like an 8-hour hack, that application was built. Now, that concept is being commercialized. So this is an app that will hit the App Store in January. It's a social trivia app. So name that tune, identify fake band names, other types of social trivia where if you're opening up the app, you can play against your friends wherever they are. This is a fun one that uses our audio analysis stuff. So this app turns any tune into a swing tune using our audio manipulation. So here's an example of Guns N' Roses as a swing band. We gotta wait for the vocals. We won't get into the copyright implications of what we've just done to Guns N' Roses. One more app I'll show you. This is a social music discovery app. So it's like a Pandora for everyone in the room. You open up the app, you shake your phone, it'll pull all of our collective music preferences based on what we've been listening to in the phone and generate a playlist based on all of our collective preferences. And then everyone in the room can kind of vote down tracks and vote up tracks. So it's taking advantage of being location aware and aggregating all of our music tastes to create a single station. So all these apps were conceived and built at these music hack days. So just looking at the numbers for a second, about 350 developers at the Boston Hack Day working for about 24 hours straight on these applications. This one was at Microsoft Nerd. So it's at it's One Memorial. And then the hacking takes place, it's through the night. So in other locations, people will kind of crash for a little while, and it'll go straight through. At Nerd, they've got to close the building at 10. So then we hosted everyone at our office throughout the night, and you know we kicked people out at around 6 in the morning, and they were back at it, you know, a couple hours later to present their hacks. So it's just an incredible resource. I mean, people are doing this because they love creating music applications, because they want to play a role in reshaping the way people experience music. So just some dumb numbers on the application development resource in Boston Music Hack Day, over $1 million worth of developer resource and time, totally focused on innovating around new music applications. But most of that ends up on the shelf because of this choke point. Unlike pretty much every other creative industry segment, if you're a screenwriter, if you're a musician, there's a value chain in place to help to allow you to focus on creating an experience and then putting support around you to commercialize the experience. So you're not expected to, a musician's not expected to understand a controlled composition clause in a record deal. There's an industry built around them to help commercialize creative works. That's not the case in the app development world. So these application developers may want to commercialize, but they don't have access to the handful of digital business development guys at a handful of record labels to get those deals done. And we hear a lot of tired cliches around this kind of the tension or previously adversarial relationship between application developers and copyright holders. And on one side of the debate, developers don't care about copyright, right? So developers don't respect the business, they just want to infringe, and certainly there are examples of that. If you guys are familiar with iMeme or Grooveshark or some of these venture-backed companies and applications that rather than go through the hassle of negotiating with record labels, they just grabbed all the content, hid behind some service provider protections in some cases, but launched without basically paying any money back to the copyright holders. Among the developers that we work with and that are trying to commercialize these applications, they know those days are over. So you can't really build a commercial application by infringing first and licensing later. That earlier approach is tired and doesn't really work at all anymore. And you're not going to get anyone to write you a check to do that. And the second cliche, the established industry doesn't get it. So record labels don't understand what APIs are. They don't want to support application development activity. And that's not what we've seen either. Record labels have a lot of constituencies to deal with, from the artist manager, the artist themselves, the music publisher, a record deal that could have been done way before the idea of an iPhone application ever existed. So they face some real challenges too. And one of the biggest challenges they face is sorting through who all these application developers are, the transaction costs. Record label has maybe a half a dozen people who can do these deals. And they have hundreds and hundreds of application developers walking in their doors to try to license content. The way those deals are done, they look a lot like record deals. They take a long time to get done. The transaction costs just don't allow them to engage with so many developers. So what we've been working on is open content APIs, where if the content owners collectively have blessed a licensing regime and a business model, like iTunes, 99-cent downloads, the rights that the user has to download a copy of that track, take it pretty much anywhere, if they're comfortable with that business model, why not expose it to every other application developer out there? DMCA streaming, so Pandora, people familiar with the DMCA and non-interactive webcast? So the idea here behind Pandora and these other services is that there's a level of interactivity, so you can kind of personalize a channel, but you can't pick the specific track that you want to listen to. And on-demand streaming, which is kind of every track at your fingertips all the time. All three of these models are essentially been embraced across the industry. You won't find, with the exception of the DMCA, you won't find any of them in the copyright code. But the industry is basically built around licensing norms here. So if there's a norm and all the content owners are comfortable with that business model, why not extend it to more and more developers? And the
Wait, why is that called DMCA streaming? Like, I know Digital Millennium Copyright Act, right?
Yeah, it's so within the DMCA, there's a definition of non-interactive webcast eligibility for a compulsory license for public performance. So Pandora, if they're compliant with the safe harbor in the DMCA, it was in the DMCA, which is called the digital complement. So it actually specifically states you can't play three tracks on the same record within like a 3-hour period of time. So there are specific rules that you need to follow. If you follow those rules, if you're compliant, DMCA compliant, then you can pay a compulsory license fee, from SoundExchange and go ahead and launch the service. So the point is, you got to pay, but it's a compulsory license, so you don't have to individually negotiate with any content owners to go off and launch that service. The difficulty is, where do you get a catalog of 800,000 tracks in Pandora's case, or a larger catalog of tracks? What we've done is work with a company that's licensed 10 million tracks and essentially built at a DMCA, the digital complement rules, into a playlisting engine. So an app developer can create that Pandora-style application without having to build any of the copyright law compliance rules into the app. So we're basically taking each of these business models, which are essentially, here's the content, here's how the content owners have to get paid, and extending it from one large entity that has the legal resources to do that. Seven Digital is a company in the UK that we're working with. It's licensed 10 million tracks globally for retail and for non-interactive webcasts. And basically opening up their content in a developer API to any other third-party developer out there, provided that they comply with the usage requirements. So the benefit here is, well, there are a few, I guess, comparing it to the alternative, which, you know, there's at the Rethink Music session that we did here at Berkman, there's a lot of talk about copyright reform and a trial license and trying to push a trial license through for copyright legislation. Naturally, copyright reform is going to take a really, really long time. And if there is industry consensus on these types of business models, allowing access through an open developer API is a lot more efficient. Similarly, lowering transaction costs. So that record label who's dealing with hundreds and hundreds of application developers and having to paper all those different deals. If that deal were available in a ClickWrap license and any developer could essentially opt in, dramatically lowering the transaction cost to license content. But again, still ensuring compliance. And then finally, a filtering mechanism. So the Seven Digitals of the world, the Echoness of the world, can kind of serve like a scout for those content owners. So the content owner who's not sure who's the quality application developer, who has a commercial shot, by working with third parties and extending their rights through developer APIs, we're able to reach a lot more developers, get them access at considerably lower transaction costs, but still encourage that application development in music. And if you look at just about every other creative segment, leveraging a creative community, be it YouTube, be it Facebook's application developer community, is really central to building a dynamic creative economy around creative works and how people are interacting with them. Same applies in music, and we see the API as a way to get around and cut through a lot of the problems around licensing and transaction costs. That's it. I'm happy to take questions on that piece of it. And as a music data company, we are kind of a walking music copyright exam too. So I can also talk about some of the other challenges that that we're dealing with. Shoot.
I heard the CEO of Pandora speak around a month ago, mm-hmm. and he was talking about the fact that they've been around for a really long time, like 10 years.
Yep.
And at the time that they started, all the big players were in the game, you know, Microsoft and AOL and all sorts of people. And he was asked about why he thinks Pandora is still around and ultimately emerged victorious. And he said he felt it was because of that human element of having all the musicians, giving them day jobs, putting them in the room with the headphones, mm-hmm. the process that you described. And that actually made their results better than something automated. So what do you think of that?
The man versus machine debate. I think discussions about it in the abstract they're just tough to have, right? I think in the end it comes to the quality of the data and the results. And I think we're at a point now where we're powering personalized radio for for MTV, for Mog, Thumbplay, for Spotify, a handful of other companies. And we're doing it for an enormous catalog. I think one of the differences between what we're doing or what Thumbplay's doing and allowing personalization for a catalog of 10 million tracks versus what Pandora's doing is Pandora is a radio service, right? They are programmed radio. And one of the things they're working a lot on now is in programming genre stations and trying to look a little bit more like FM broadcast radio, because that's the service that they've got. They do a great job, right? So I think an argument as to whether or not our results are better than Pandora's that's cocktail conversation, right? I mean, we can always argue about what the best playlist is for a given seed artist. I think the technology is certainly there that it works today. And 10 years ago, it did not work. Pandora was really the only reliable alternative, or really the only reliable kind of personalized playlisting option now. Last.fm is a technology-based approach acquired by CBS. They now power radio for Yahoo and for AOL. There's humans in there, though, right? I mean, if you look at what we're doing, we're aggregating what everyone on the web is saying about all these artists, and we're basically pulling in all those descriptive terms. So though I admire Pandora paying musicians to do so, they have problems, and they've been pretty open with us about the problems. Like, they have a klezmer music problem. For them to deliver a klezmer music channel, they need in the neighborhood of 5,000 tracks for them to allow people to navigate through a microgenre of music. Now, they want to serve that klezmer audience that's out there, but can they put an army of musicians to index and understand klezmer music? Well, no. So there are edges to the system. That's just what they're dealing with their approach. A machine-only approach would be analyzing audio signal alone. And there have been a number of companies that have tried that, and you get some weird stuff. You can't tell the difference between Christian rock and death metal, right? So they may sound a lot alike, but they are very, very different. You get also some interesting overlaps between, like, lo-fi punk and country, because the audio, the production is about the same. Chord progressions, tempo, a lot of the stuff are similar, but very different cultural attributes. So without people, that's what you'd be left with. We're trying to combine a human element to it, too.
Sounds like the time I tried to make up a Pandora station based on Lindsay Lohan, and I was appalled to discover that I actually brought up things I liked. So, like, you know, not that I'm...
Two questions. I was wondering if your platform also had payment mechanisms available to it. So, for example, if you make it some money off some ad, or the person pays for the app, the money gets back in an easy way, or is that out of scope? And two, I was wondering if any of the features of the music, like tempo and pace and rhythm and things like that, is that in any way covered by copyright?
That's a really interesting question. So, on the payment piece, the Echonest hasn't. We don't offer any payment mechanisms directly. What we're doing with some of our partners, like 7 Digital, has a full white labeled store. If you're on a BlackBerry or on a Samsung device, the music store there is 7 Digital's back end. So they have all the e-commerce and kind of retail fulfillment there. They are making that available through our API to our smaller developers. So we're partnering with people to deal with some of those things. We're not dealing with the payments themselves. I think issues around virtual currency and virtual goods around music applications, there's a big opportunity there. No one's really figured that out. Done a great job in the gaming segment. No one's addressing it in music. It's something that we're looking at, but not something we're doing today. The question as to whether or not and our audio analysis is somehow a derivative of the copyrighted work is a question we've run up against a couple of times. There hasn't been, in the history of kind of music metadata or digital music metadata, there are a couple of companies. There's Gracenote. Anyone here familiar with Gracenote? So formerly CDDB. Everyone in this room has probably worked for Gracenote. If you've ever slid a CD into iTunes or into your computer and typed in the metadata, you're working for CDDB. they use an audio fingerprint. So they're analyzing the track, really just to basically to match it to a track ID and give you the basic metadata. There hasn't been any litigation around whether or not what they're doing or what we're doing is a derivative work. I mean, the arguments that we've made with the content owners are, basically it's descriptive, right? And it's facts, and it's probably not copyrightable material. The derivative is probably what you're calling a derivative is probably not a copyrighted work itself. It's a fact. But it's an interesting question that we've been asked in a number of cases. I mean, basically, there's not been an incentive on either side to get into that argument because the content owners desperately need the metadata. I mean, though I think there's been the occasional business affairs guys who see a royalty opportunity there, I think it's such a rat's nest that it hasn't been something that's really been pressed. Got.
Have you done a breakdown at all from the 6,000 developers of which countries are represented, or where are these developers coming from geographically?
Actually, we just did a survey, and we made the mistake of doing free text, where do you live? So I'll get back to you in probably a year when we get through all the results.
Mm. What's your hunch?
It's a pretty international community. So if we use Music Hack Days as a proxy to kind of where this activity is taking place, Music Hack Days have taken place in Berlin, in Amsterdam, in Stockholm. There's one in Sao Paulo coming up. Talking about India this year too.
Argentina?
Not on the books. But in our developer API, I've seen a lot of forum activity with there's a Brazilian, pretty active kind of front-end app development community in Brazil, in Brisbane, in Australia.
There's the Middle East?
Not that I've seen. You seen anything? I know that's anecdotal, but it's, you know, certainly really active in Europe, and, you know, we've seen a couple of other pretty active pockets, too.
I have my own little internet radio station, which gets about 30. Well, it has a maximum of 30, but occasionally if I post the URL on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, there are like several bots that log in and sometimes listen to it for a while. Like, is that possibly one of your competitors listening in and analyzing random streams for some reason?
Yeah, so we analyze audio from the web. So we don't grab audio streams, but if MP3s are posted out there, we'll analyze them. So we're constantly crawling the web and identifying. If you're a music blogger and you're writing about a track and you're posting that track, we're going to analyze the text that you've written, and we're going to know what tracks you've posted, and we'll analyze that audio.
Can you talk about sort of how you're doing the analyzing and what the back end is?
Sure. So there's on the audio analysis side, basically, it's binary software that we send out. It's a lightweight binary that will analyze an audio track in about 3 seconds. It's custom stuff that we've basically built. It's Tristan Jahans, our co-founder. It's the stuff that he was developing at the Media Lab. We also offer that as a web service. So in our API, you can upload a track. We host the analysis software on our side, and we'll give you back the audio analysis data. Now that we've indexed north of 16 million tracks, we also make that analysis data available without you having to basically bring the track with you. So if you can now look up audio attribute data just with a track ID, and we'll return the data. On the cultural analysis side, it's highly customized kind of web search and semantic analysis, kind of amalgam of some open source stuff and a pretty big web crawling infrastructure that we've built. We use Solr and Lucene on the data indexing side. Basically, it's a whole bunch of web crawlers that dump a whole bunch of index text, and then Brian's written a bunch of basically code to analyze that text and pull out the musically informative terms.
How can you talk a little bit about your finances or business model or whatever you want to call it?
Yeah, sure. So we're a data licensing company. So though we have an open developer API, the open access to the platform is for non-commercial use. If you're a commercial application developer, we make money from you in two ways. One, we charge you a recurring license fee. So we'll charge you a monthly fee for access to the data, kind of the same way that Gracenote or Music Guide does. But then we also take a piece of the application. So we have a revenue interest in every application that's built on the platform. If you're MTV, you're willing to pay a greater license fee, and you don't want to share as much of your revenue with us. So the ratio of baseline to revenue participation is different than if you're the guy who built, we have a couple of jogging playlisting applications that use our tempo data to beat match your playlists with the pace that you're working out at. A couple of these guys are, they're like one-man development shops. So in those instances, we take a much larger percentage of the application and charge a lower recurring fee. Sure. Any other questions? We have a lot of students, right? So I'd say about 15 or 18% of our development community are people still in school. So I'm not sure how many of those are undergrad or grad students in music information retrieval. But I'd say, you look at a Music Hack Day crowd, most of those guys are in their 20s. And most of them are guys. I think the percentage of females at the last Music Hack Day was like 5%. Yeah.
Have you had scholarly interest in analyzing your data?
Yeah, I had an interesting conversation with Yochai Benkler about some of the analysis of the activity data. He's looking at open access to music and some of the music marketing approaches where independent artists are giving away their audio for free as a kind of a way to attract users and generate revenue and touring and those types of things. So we do have really interesting data on play count and how artists are trending across the web. So we talked at the at the Rethink Music Conference about possibly getting some of that data in his hands.
Yeah, the aggregate data for the apps downloaded, music is doing pretty well. It's number 4 or 5 down the list.
Yep.
Is it just a few apps that make most of that, or is it spread out over apps and new apps coming into being all the time?
Yeah, so we actually did some analysis of that as well, and we were surprised to see the amount of churn. We didn't expect as much churn as we saw. So there is a fair amount of diversity. What we looked at was for iOS only. We looked at the top 100 music applications by month in 2010, bundled them into categories, for example, non-interactive streaming, music games, a handful of categories. And then we looked at the amount of churn within that category. So how many new names are we seeing throughout the year? And streaming was one that really surprised me. I expected to see Pandora and Slacker, and that's it. But there were 34 different apps that were in the top 100 throughout the year in that category alone. So I'd say there's still a fair amount of diversity. Artist-specific applications.
Still, you use the word still, so you suspect some consolidation will happen?
No, throughout the year, we've seen it, and it remains to be. We haven't seen any consolidation yet. I mean, it's still kind of a hits business, so what we looked at is the top 100, right? So we didn't look at the bottom X thousand, right? We don't have access to that data. We've talked to a couple of the artist-specific application developers, like familiar with Smule, IMT Pain. It was probably the most popular music game of last year. I think it had about 4.5 million downloads. But that's a single artist, kind of artist-specific application. Those are kind of popping up with different application developers.
It'd be interesting to see, I don't know if it's probably already done, but to have these 6,000 apps in the same room with video game designers, like in the same room.
Yeah, it's...
Or filmmakers in the same room, to see them collaborate in the same room would be interesting.
It's part of what we're trying to do. So what we're trying to do is connect a record label on one side with different types of application developers on the other side. Mm-hmm. And I certainly think the music space in our company still has a lot to learn from gaming, both in how to create a more easily monetized user experience that's more engaged, in some of the payment options, and on just the application development side as a whole. If you're talking to any of the, we're talking to the major labels all the time, and that's certainly an area where they are investing on the business development side to encourage more game application development around music content.
Cool.
You were saying that for commercial uses, they would have to pay licensing fees or whatever for to use your service. But earlier you were saying that like one of the obstacles to developers is they have to do, if they're selling the music, they have to negotiate that licensing for the actual music itself, right?
Yep.
So a commercial someone developing a commercial app would have the licensing to use your service and then go separately through some other licensing company like 7Digital.
We've basically kind of click wrapped it, right?
I wasn't sure if that's what you wanted to do or if you had done that. Okay.
Yeah. So wherever we can,
yeah.
We want to create basically a uniform, uniform rule. So, on the 7Digital piece, if you sell a download through 7Digital, 7Digital is kicking back an affiliate fee to us, and we're sharing that with the developer. So we take a penny or two, and the developer makes about a nickel. Mm-hmm. So that's built into the application, and that's a ClickWrap license. So ClickWrap licenses are not a panacea. They just don't flat out don't work in some cases. For example, rhythm games. Mm-hmm. Rhythm games require not just... We have record labels who will do a blanket deal, and they'll say, we'll hang on to X percent of all revenue generated from this application. Developer in the Echo Nest, you've got this other piece of the pie here, you figure it out. Mm-hmm. But that's not it. You still got to go off and negotiate with the publishers, the music publishers. Okay. And so where you have four major record labels that cover a fair amount of the kind of the content that people are getting their hands on, those four major record labels catalogs probably end up meaning 100 music publishers. So being able to go off and negotiate with each of those, a kind of out-of-the-box package where a Guitar Hero-style game application can go in and click a ClickWrap license is a ways away. Mm-hmm. We are working with one independent aggregator, which are basically like digital distributors for independent record labels. Mm-hmm. Many independent record labels also own the publishing, or often the artists control their own publishing. So we will create a sandbox of independence where both sides, recording mm-hmm. and publishing, is cleared. Mm-hmm. But doing that for kind of the canon of stuff you would want is a ways off.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that I assume you want to have happen, but you can't be actively involved in making it happen.
Yeah, well, so we'd like to play a part in making it happen, but we also know that that's a trail of tears. Yeah. And so... We'll play a part, but we can't bet the business on it because it's going to take a long time. And some of those inefficiencies are, frankly, how publishers make their money. It's not a bad thing, right? But mm-hmm. but it's also a good thing, right? I mean, another example, that sync license that comes in where someone wants to use your song in a commercial, if there were a published across the board price for that, your ability to negotiate a really great deal for that independent artist mm-hmm. Goes away. And as a former music lawyer, some of the best deals that I did absolutely were independent musicians who got a couple hundred, one guy in particular got a couple hundred thousand dollar license, a sync license that allowed him to quit his day job and became a professional musician. If he had the opportunity to kind of put that stuff out there in a pre-cleared license, we wouldn't be able to benefit from that inefficiency too. So, you know, I understand why there's some benefit to holding that stuff back too.
Sure.
Since you're so close to the copyright issue, know, do you see any trends in terms of solving the problems of musicians, you know, holding on to their copyright? Basically, you know, what, having all the kids, you know, copy their music without paying for it. Do you see any answer or solution coming down the pike?
So, I think cloud-based access to music that offers a superior alternative to peer-to-peer is the best solution we've got, right? If you're accessing music primarily through a smartphone or through a mobile device, it's going to increasingly become the case. If Spotify and Rhapsody and Pandora and other licensed services just flat out create a better experience than going through a file sharing network, I think that's the best opportunity that we've got. Now, if you look at the economics of those services and what they mean to the artist as opposed to selling a record in a store, the economics are different, right? I mean, a user's interaction on Pandora is worth considerably less to that artist than the purchase of a physical CD or to the label or whomever. But I think it's basically a race to deliver a better user experience, and I think we're starting to see that a growing number of the music population is willing to pay for that application, for a more engaging way to interact with the content. I think that's the best that we've got right now. Any other questions?
These apps, they cost a couple of dollars, right?
Well, yeah. Yeah, in reference to your question, the app itself, a paid app costs a couple of bucks. Access to an on-demand catalog of 10 million tracks costs about 10 bucks a month as a service. The application is free. So I have Rhapsody and RDO and a couple of other applications on my phone. I am a subscriber to those services, so download the app for free, but I'm paying a subscription fee for access.
So how much in aggregate would the revenue stream of all that be for somebody like you? I mean, you and all your competitors put together.
How?
The revenue of all that put together.
How big is the music, digital? So
yeah,
the digital music market across the board last year was about a $4.5 billion industry. The app, the music app market, I don't have a number for you yet. So there are outrageously, you know, huge app, general app market numbers. If you've seen the growth over like the last 2 years, it's a couple $1 billion business now. But segmenting music alone, don't have an answer for you right now.
Well, along the same lines, if it was $4.5 billion last year, and that was almost entirely buying tracks and downloading them, is that
three and change?
Okay, if it all moves to $10 a month, big hypothesis. But if it all were to move into the cloud and be $10 a month, mm-hmm. $320 a year, what would that market shrink to?
Well, it depends on how big the subscriber base is, right? I mean, I don't necessarily...
The subscriber base as... So this is not maybe an answerable question, but if everybody... So the subscriber base is everybody who downloaded music last year, mm-hmm. In that 3 billion figure. If they all moved, you know...
Yeah, so...
Order of magnitude, yes.
Yeah, well, one way to answer it, I think the ARPU for a digital music consumer in the U.S. right now is about $55 a year. From the Census Statistical Abstract took a look at basically what that, how I think it's maybe household spend.
And what was it in the CD days?
Don't know. But so if you're talking about taking it, from $55 to $120, you know, there's more money there. The question is whether or not. I think one of the big questions is whether or not we're going to see widespread adoption of a cloud music service at $10 a month. What Google is rumored to be working on, where we know that they are working on, are remote access services or digital locker services, where you may not have access to all 10 million tracks. You might have access to some subset of that, or the stuff that you've previously bought or that you have in a hard drive for a couple dollars a month. Labels are also working with ISPs and MSOs to offer a opt-out service in the $5 a month or $3 a month range, just because if you've got an addressable, like, you know, you've got a 30 million subscriber base, I don't know how many of those 30 million can itemize what's in their cable bill today or what's in their mobile bill today. So the idea is, if by creating an opt-out, you can see penetration rates a hell of a lot higher than you're seeing today. The subscription business is still, you know, in its infancy. In the U.S., Rhapsody's been around for 8+ years. They've got about 750,000 subscribers. They're about flat, right? They just haven't really grown. These new services like RDO and Mog and Thumbplay haven't really built meaningful user bases over the last year. Strangely, though, in Europe, Spotify has grown to close to 1 million subscribers over the past little over a year. So whether or not that's a function of Spotify's ability to market and the quality of their offering, or it's a difference between the European music consumer and the American one, is, you know, it's probably a little bit of both. And until Spotify launches in the U.S., we won't have a firm answer.
Services gone away to solving the problem of accessing from your car, which, at least I'm sure for me and probably a lot of people, that's probably the only time we listen to regular FM and AM radio at all.
So we're working with a number of companies now who look at the car as a critical land grab over the next couple of years, right? So moving from your radio dial to a couple of pre-installed audio applications in Dash is a big focus of music data companies and those content companies who want to be one of the pre-installed streaming services in that car. You know, the obvious question is, if the car's got an audio in and you've got a smartphone, what's with all the argument? What's with that battle for the dashboard? But if you look at probably the most successful music subscription service in the U.S., it's XM Sirius Radio, and they've got 20 million subscribers. And they got there by basically eliminating the friction to subscribe. It was in the car, it was turned on, it was enabled. You had to do more work probably to shut it off after your 3-month trial than the other way around. And so a lot of content or subscription-oriented content businesses get built.
When you're describing apps, it's like $10 a month.
Yep.
So the DMCA is really instrumental in that's sort of in defining what that provides over just free services, say through Echo Nest, if you were just using a free app, right?
Yeah, so
The distinction is those you're saying, like three songs from the same album or something like that?
Let me clarify it a little bit better than that. So non-interactive webcast, if you're eligible to be a non-interactive webcaster, if you're a commercial service, which I think is north of $2.5 million in revenue, you're paying on a per stream basis. It's a fraction of a penny, and if you there was basically the kind of what that rate is, what that penny rate is, was in the news again last week.
Penny rate per song?
Yeah, it's a fraction of a penny. It's a couple of zeros, 1.9. And it goes up a fraction every year. And that's the Copyright Royalty Arbitration Board, or CARP, strangely enough, sets those rates, right? And there's been a ton of negotiation on both sides, webcasters, content owners, what that rate is. If you're under the $2.5 million in revenue, there's a small webcaster carve-out where you can pay a percentage of your revenue or percentage of your cost, whichever one's greater, which is, I think, a great opportunity for an independent application developer. So all you need is the content. If you've got that content, like in Pandora's case, they buy CDs at Amazon. They actually buy the CD, rip it, and then they stream it. You're just paying that compulsory rate. You need the catalog. Mm-hmm. Once you've got it, you're just paying that compulsory rate, which could be a percentage of revenue for those little guys. That's a great opportunity.
So then I guess I was misunderstanding. I thought you licensed with 7Digital. You licensed the rights to access it, but not actually owning the music itself, like having it to play.
So what we've done with 7Digital are two things. You can do the paid downloads like iTunes, and you can do DMCA-compliant streaming. So we'll put our rules on top of it. You, small webcaster, you need to go off and pay the royalty rates, but as long as you comply with the reporting, you're cool, because that catalog we've basically put together for you. Mm-hmm. The third category, which is on-demand subscription services, like a Rhapsody, we're working with one company now called PlayMe, which is a Sony joint venture, a competitor to Rhapsody, where you can now build applications that have full interactive streaming into them, and PlayMe is paying these third-party application developers as an affiliate, basically. So you can build an app that's plainly enabled. Mm-hmm. If someone tries it and starts subscribing, you get a nice affiliate piece. But Playme's gone out and negotiated all of those licenses, mm-hmm. which is a long and brutal process. Yeah. The point where actually they lost their deal with Universal over basically Universal's catalog's no longer in the Playme service because mm-hmm. of those difficulties. So even on the on-demand piece, we don't have a complete offering to the application developers today.
So are you selling your data streams to the advertisers and the advertising industry, you know, who are trying to match up
yep.
More refine who they're selecting to tie into? And how does that, you know, you see video, YouTube, and mm-hmm. you see those predictable content providers getting advertising dollars on YouTube, mm-hmm. and the unpredictable ones not getting any advertising dollars. You know, is that happening out there to pay for it, to get around the copyright, loss of copyright?
Yeah, dollars? So it is to some degree. So how our data is being applied in marketing to consumers, record labels pay us for data. First, so they're marketing to music consumers, and we've got obviously really relevant data to help them target where likely consumers of a certain style of music or a certain artist are on the web. Music as a proxy to audience for targeted advertising is something we're doing with one company today who is in the ad-supported music business. I'd say as a whole, the targeting market isn't quite to the point where micro-targeting around music consumption is where they're focused. It's still really about massive reach, and it's about cooking users who want to buy a car, who are going to buy a plane ticket, right? And if you can identify those auto intenders, or that's where I think the real data exchange and targeting market is still, there's more money there right now. And we aren't kind of down the chain to the point of micro-targeting that experimental electronic kind of music fan on a per user basis.
How about getting some of the brands or advertisers closer to the developers? Like, I know a lot of brands yeah. are interested in having experiments being done on their behalf and funding those experiments
yep.
to create all kinds of content that's useful.
Yep. So we're doing that now. So we're a matchmaker between some large licensed services and application developers. We had a handful of agencies come to us. I mean, some of our developers are people who work at digital agencies, right? But now we've actually had a couple of brands in the last quarter who've expressed interest in building applications or having an application built, and we've made some connections there. From a business standpoint, it's a little tricky to scale. You know, we're not interested in becoming a digital agency, but we are interested in trying to connect those types of commercial opportunities with independent developers. There's definitely more and more of it going on. And the content owners are chasing those dollars because it's a great way to, one, get co-op support in anticipation of a new album release, so if you're working with a good sponsor. And it's one of the few remaining sources of the one big check. So labels are also in our working with labels around an app ecosystem, certainly presenting that stuff out to sponsors and branded entertainment companies is a big part of it.
I just have a geeky question. I'm wondering how big would a catalog of a couple million titles be, terabytes, and how many of those are sitting around the world? Like, do you end up having one of these yourself, or you're interfacing with a different one?
So I was told there'll be no math.
So I don't know.
So I'm
just curious, like how you know everything is put in terms of like Library of Congress's sort of. So I'm just wondering like how big.
MP3s 5 megs, 10 million tracks, the average catalog.
Yeah. Okay.
So how many of those catalogs are out there?
Like, way, are you maintaining one? Of
way
them
too
now?
Many, right? Yeah. So another huge inefficiency is the fact that when Universal Music Group or Warner Music Group sends out their updates. So every Tuesday they're pushing new releases, and sometimes they're also taking stuff down that, you know, that they need to take down for whatever reason. They're pushing that out to several hundred different services, right? It's incredibly inefficient. There should be a central repository where there's one big catalog sitting on, you know, multiple CDNs that everyone's accessing, and that metadata is all clean and easily accessible. Absolutely should happen. It's gonna happen someday. But what's happened in every attempt to do that ends up being some industry consortium that spends a year or so and kind of gathering all the content, and then you've got four big competitors who can't even be in the same room for antitrust reasons, who don't want to standardize to another player, and for all of those kind of competitive reasons, you still end up with hundreds of these catalogs sitting different places out there. I mean, it's totally inefficient. All with different metadata, too. What's that?
Why don't you do it? You have more data, it sounds like, than just about anybody.
So we're doing it in a way, right? So we're wrapping all of our contextual understanding of those catalogs on top of the audio itself. But for the reasons I just described, I think it's going to be a long time before there's an industry solution for that problem.
But you don't need anybody's permission.
No, you do. I mean, if you're going to host and stream the content?
No, to publish the catalog, the metadata.
I think there was a...
Oh.
I think there's a breakdown in terms, because when you were talking about catalog, I was wondering if does catalog mean the metadata or catalog mean the actual content?
Yeah, I work in a library, so catalog means the metadata, exactly, not the content.
All right, so in my when we talk about someone's catalog, we're talking about their music catalog, so it would be the audio and the metadata. On the metadata side, it's exactly what we are doing. So, and actually, it goes to one of the walking copyright exam issues that we deal with is we're very interested in opening up music metadata. So we believe that music metadata is a perfect commons-based approach to opening up and cleaning up music metadata. So the 50 ways that you can, and we've done this in a number of areas. So one of the least sexy problems in music application development is the 50 ways you can misspell Guns N' Roses or Bjork, and reconcile them down to a single ID in a really clean way. Now, we're a text analysis company, so we've got probably one of the best approaches to auto-correcting that stuff and putting them down to a single ID. We released something called Rosetta, and here's a related problem. So I'm building a music service, and I want to incorporate lyrics and tour dates and buy links, right? So you go to your lyrics guy, and you say, okay, I need lyrics for this track. He said, okay, here you go. Here's my ID structure for my 10 million songs and lyrics. Go to the tour guy. Okay, here are my IDs. And then you go to 7 Digital. Here are my IDs. They're three different ID sets for 10 million tracks. And they say, well, you got to use ours. Figure it out. And so the amount of time that's going into just dealing with that level kind of metadata problem, we released an open service called Rosetta Stone, where you can drop your IDs into our system and we can map to any other system. And it's a free service. So we've released an open source audio fingerprint with an open data kind of rules on it. So you can access our audio fingerprinter, similar to what Gracenote charges money for, and do lookups against our database of tracks for free. The deal is, if you are compiling additional fingerprints, you've got to share them. We have to share them too. So the idea is to create a licensing structure where all the incentives are there that if you're going to be part of this collective in building a single metadata database for music, that you can't hoard it. You've got to share all the data that that you're using. And so we opened up our fingerprinter a couple months ago, and we're starting to work with some big services who want to be part of this, because it's just a necessary evil. No one likes paying for basic track level metadata. No one likes spending engineering resource and cleaning it up. And we're believers that by opening that up, making it a free service, developers will spend more time and more money on, you know, the kind of higher level stuff in the stack.
Joseph's question, which part of it was, do you maintain your own collection?
So certainly on if catalog means what librarians define catalog as, yes. I mean, that's the business, right? If you looked at basically that slide I showed with all of that data, I mean, we've got this gigantic database of track ID, all those attributes, all the basic metadata that's constantly growing.
Okay.
was curious about the content too.
Yeah, we don't stream any content from our servers now, because for us to do that, we've got to go off and do those licenses. There have been two companies that have tried to solve that problem and be the kind of white label audio fulfillment for everybody. MediaNet, which has not done particularly well, and 7 Digital, who is actually doing pretty well in the consumer electronics space. Their rights are limited, but they are they're growing and they're doing well.
Can I just push on this for one more second?
Sure. You
didn't quite answer. Do you maintain, when you're spidering, you're analyzing in 2 seconds, are you maintaining a copy of the music itself?
There's
10 million tracks somewhere, or 16 million tracks somewhere on a service?
No. So most...
And would you tell us if you did?
Yeah, sure. Okay. I mean, we're all friends here, right? Let me disable my microphone for a minute. No. The majority of the data that we get, 90, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's almost all of it come from us sending out that binary that phones home with the data. So we sent...
Doesn't it have to move the MP3 or whatever, the track, onto your server so you can analyze it?
No, we'll send software out to that server or to your device and analyze the audio on that device, and then ship back basically JSON files that say, you know, the basic track description information and our descriptive data of the track. So we don't need to put audio next to it for most of the tracks. In our API, you can upload tracks and get back analysis. So those tracks, we analyze them. We blow away that stuff over time because basically our index of audio analysis data doesn't sit with the audio in all cases. Not saying it wouldn't be nice. So if we make huge dramatic changes to our analyzer, we don't have that audio to go back to. So there are some issues with it, but we don't have a catalog of, you know, millions and millions of tracks of audio on our side.
Thanks. Hmm? So let me try and summarize what I've understood of your model, and then you tell me where I went wrong. So you provide a platform for application developers, and that's why they flock to you, and it's basically free. With that, the contacts with this whole ecosystem of developers, you can go to the labels, and they will be interested in dealing with you, and you can be an agent between the two. And then you get paid, you clock at both ends, both the developers and the labels, but most of the money comes from the labels.
Yep. The only additional point distinction I'd make is that it's not just labels, right? It's also other large services that have licensed content, right? Like the MTVs and Thumbplays and 7 Digitals of the world.
All right. So. Cool.
Any other questions?
So it sounds like you have
sort of the potential to be sort of a Trimmer Media or Double Click of the audio world.
Yes. Well, so we view ourselves as that data layer for what is one of the most popular forms of entertainment consumption, or the most popular, or the data layer for music consumption. I'm running a constant analogy contest, so you've just entered yourself. If anyone else has any ideas, I'm all ears. I've been at this for almost 4 years, and I still don't have a good one. You know, Google for Music is one that we won't use, because Google for anything is you know, the most kind of tired cliche out there. But in a way, maybe like ITA for music. We've got a lot of ITA in the travel space. We've got a lot of data about music, which is an enormous, ever-changing landscape, and we're licensing that data and enabling smarter applications on it. It's not an analogy that I just used. You know, Tremor, I think, is probably more of a, you know, more of a streaming advertising and interactive advertising platform, right? DoubleClick, kind of the same type of thing. Platform, we're both platforms in that sense, but what makes our platform unique is the data that we've got, not in our kind of distribution network out there. Thanks a lot.